Thank you all for coming tonight. My name's Heather Paulson, and I work in the Children's Library here. And I first became acquainted with Mr. Peck's book when I was on a long road trip, actually traveling from California to New York. And I read the book out loud with my soon-to-be mother-in-law as we drove across the country. And it was, needless to say, the book was a wonderful experience. Reading A Year Down Yonder was a great experience, reading it in the car, traveling across the country. And when I began working at the New York Society Library and found out that Mr. Peck was a member, I was just absolutely thrilled, and I'm very excited to have him here tonight. And Mr. Peck's writing ranges from award-winning mysteries to ghost stories to contemporary novels. And across all genres, he maintains a witty, introspective, and unique voice. A Season of Gifts is his 30th novel and provides yet another look into the witty, tenacious, and often sort of spirited generosity of Grandma Dowdle. And one of the things that I think is most amazing about Mr. Peck is that he is able to continuously impress audiences with a dowdy old grandmother. And somebody who's able to do that is an amazing writer and has incredible gifts. So I'm pleased to welcome him up here to the podium, and I'd ask that after the event that you all stay and toast Mr. Peck's 30th novel with us. And also, this is his 25th year as a library member, so we'll be, Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, will come and give a nice toast for him. So without further ado, welcome Mr. Peck.
Ladies and gentlemen, I had a mother who read to me. As evening proceeded apace, light the lamp and turn the page and be, oh, any place. Pirates there were and palaces and a raft at the river's bend. I warmed my face at the story's light, hoping it wouldn't end. I had a mother who read to me as the afternoon ebbed away and stories stirred in the darkening wood. And that's why I'm here today. I expect that's why you're here today, too. In fact, some of you are here with your mothers. And how glad I am that we are readers and writers meeting to keep Christmas at the New York Society Library, the spiritual home of readers and writers for more than 250 years. The spiritual home of the late Walter Lord, a neighbor from 68th Street, who wrote that book, Beloved of All Boys, Including Me, A Night to Remember, about the sinking of the Titanic. In my novels, the Titanic has sunk twice because of that book, and may sink again. And Tom Wolfe, whose spiritual home this is, who put the Upper East Side on the map with The Bonfire of the Vanities, a book that a lot of us are sure takes place in our own apartment buildings. And this is the season to recall a New York Society library trustee from the year 1811, a classics professor named Dr. Clement C. Moore, who in 1822 wrote A Visit from St. Nicholas. And so it's just possible that Christmas as we know it was invented in this library. It's a library that does what all libraries ought to do. It conducts an annual young writers contest, so that to unleash the talents of our youngest members in the writing of their prose and their poetry. Whatever your age, writing is the loneliest job in the world. Writing is sitting in an empty room trying to make a blank page speak. As another writer has said, writing is mud wrestling with yourself. And so, how glad I am to keep Christmas with valued writing colleagues in this room. One of them is Marianne McDonald, sitting here, who has been on the stage in this room before, and whose newest book has been very well reviewed in Publishers Weekly this week. Marianne, what is that book?
Little Piano
And we have in this room a master of the picture book form, Stephen Kroll, who is sitting here and has a very timely title, which is? Perfect. And we have a landmark in our field, one of the great greats of our time, Mr. Robert Quackenbush, whose newest book is? Wonderful. We writers never retire. We just watch our backlists drop off. God bless us, everyone. And I'm here because my editor told me to write a Christmas story. And here it is, a season of gifts. But it doesn't start with Christmas. It starts in steamy, stagnant August, in that low moment of the year, just before school starts. Worse, school in a new town. Worse, you're the preacher's kid. But it starts in August to make the point that some people don't wait till Christmas to give their gifts, and that none of the really best gifts are tied up in ribbon. Writers are forever being asked where we get the ideas for our books. It is popularly assumed we can't think of them. But in fact, young readers tell me what my next book will be about. I never worry, they're going to tell me. The better readers write back. And they've been telling me for 8 years what this book is supposed to be about. The young want nothing new. They want every book, every party, every teacher, every parent, every book to be the same. So they want my most popular character back again. I resisted as long as I could. She is a woman so large, it had already taken 2 books to contain her. And she changed my life, that woman. She took me places I could never go on my own, to the White House repeatedly, to the Kremlin for the Russian National Book Festival, and not least to the Newbery Caldecott dinner twice. Her name is Grandma Dowdle, and she doesn't have a first name. Who would dare use it? More than 10 years ago, she loomed up suddenly in my life, blotting out the day in a Lane Bryant dress and an apron the size of Alaska, with rickrack, rows and rows of rickrack. When you're old, the people you knew when you were young come back in a rush, and I knew her at once. She was all my great aunts, rolled up into one big package. Mighty women born in the 1870s with fine names. Maud, Opal, Pearl, Geneva, Mildred. Not a Brittany among them. Midwestern farm women who ruled the world from black iron stoves in country kitchens hot enough to steam the calendars off the walls. Women in vast boat-shaped, laced-up Cuban-heeled shoes who had grown larger and larger with time as their husbands grew smaller and smaller and finally vanished entirely. A race of mighty women who left the small boy I was in no doubt about who ruled. Adults as strong as young people want adults to be, if they can find them. The secret to Grandma Dowdle's success is she never loses a battle to a kid. And here is Grandma Dowdle, her first time out, in a novel called A Long Way from Chicago, told by her grandson, Joey. She kept a 12-gauge double-barrel Winchester Model 21 behind the woodbox, but we figured it must have been Grandpa Dowdle's for shooting ducks. Of course it isn't. Grandpa Dowdle has long since squeezed off his last round, but Grandma Dowdle hasn't. and the whole town knows she's trigger happy. And as we know, a gun that appears on the stage when the curtain rises will be fired before the end of the third act. Chekhov said so. The second novel digs deeper. It's called A Year Down Yonder, about her granddaughter, a girl who finds her role model for life in the last place she would ever think to look for. We hope, we write in the hope, that more young people find their role models in books and fewer on Facebook. We write in the knowledge that anybody who thinks the word friend is a verb isn't one and cannot be trusted. We write in the belief that a book unites what the computer divides. Mary Alice is a girl who, in the depth of the Great Depression, a time looking more and more like now, has to go live with Grandma in that awful town and go to that school where the other students arrive by mule. And anybody who thinks small towns are friendly lives in a big city. And here is Mary Alice speaking. Being 15, I didn't tell Grandma any more about high school than I could help, but she always knew everything already anyway. So I showed her a notice from the principal. It asked for parents to bring refreshments for the Halloween party. In those times, people turned out in droves if there was anything to eat. Victuals, Grandma said, that'll mean pies. Gooseberry, I asked. She was famous for her gooseberry pie. But she waved me away. You don't make a pie out of canned fruit until the dead of winter when you don't have any choice. She spoke of the winter ahead as a war she'd be waging. I must have pictured the two of us in an igloo spearing fish through the ice. Pumpkin and pecan, she said. And we're going to be busy day and night. Girl, I hope you remember something about rolling out pie crust. And so we embark upon a scene in which an old lady who scorns the whole town and everybody in it will work day and night to feed them. She's my introduction to the bewildering world of adults to a generation who may not be able to tell one adult from another, who aren't growing up where I grew up, in the middle of a brick street lined both sides with porches, with swings full of old people monitoring the streets. We didn't need cell phones. We were never more than 90 seconds from the nearest adult. Worse, our parents knew our teachers well. But now a book is the only front porch we have left. And while when I was young, parents feared the phone call from school. Today, schools, colleges fear the phone call from parents. Grandma Dowdle fell silent for years. She'd run out of grandchildren to tell you her story, and she does not tell her own business. She's from Illinois. But the letters keep coming from her, wanting her back, and finally I had to go looking for some other young people to tell her story. Maybe grandchildren can be the people you choose and who choose you. I reread the first two books, looking for holes in them the way you do. And I found a big one in two books I had never mentioned who lived in the house next door, who had the mixed blessing of living next door to that woman. And I looked a little closer, and it was the autumn of 1958. October 1st, 1958, a moment of significant pop history. October 1st, 1958. The moment the U.S. Army shipped Elvis Presley to Germany and every teenage girl in America went into mourning. Oh, yes, I had to use it. I was in that army. It's the autumn of 1958, and the Methodist minister is just moving in next door with the wife and kids. A Methodist minister sent by the conference to start a new church from scratch in a town of 300 people that already has 11 churches. And, of course, his kids, who will need all the help they can get. And you don't see at first that help is at hand, just next door, disguised well in a Lane Bryant dress and an apron the size of Alaska, swatting Fuller brushmen off her porch with a broom. The story is A Season of Gifts, and it begins in August, but now it's Thanksgiving time. I can't read you the Christmas scene. That would give it away. And besides, Mrs. Daniel cries in that scene, so we can't have that. Though Mrs. Dowdle was no churchwoman, she was in and out all Thanksgiving week, gradually taking over the entire Methodist Feed the Hungry Thanksgiving campaign. She was everywhere Mother turned. "Who's baking them turkeys for you?" she demanded to know. When she heard it was Mrs. Pensinger, she said, "Reba Pensinger? Her turkey's dry as the bottom of a canary cage. And you could lubricate your car with her pan gravy. I'll do the birds in my oven. Have this boy bring them to the house," meaning me. Also, she thought very little of cranberry jelly in a can. "I wouldn't slop hogs with it," she said. "You can taste the can." A large cauldron of bubbling, popping cranberries and orange peel seethed on her stovetop, spiced with cinnamon sticks and whole cloves. As soon as school was over every afternoon, my little sister, Ruth Ann, stood on a kitchen chair to stir. On Thanksgiving Day itself, the Methodist men volunteered to deliver the dinners. The funeral home offered their hearse. But Dad thought it might send the wrong message to people who saw it turning in at their place. Somehow Mrs. Dowdle was in our car with us when we headed out. She hadn't dressed up. She wore her kitchen apron under her hunting jacket. Ruth Ann was in the back seat with her, also aproned. Dad was behind the wheel, and I sat beside him where I liked to be. The whole car smelled like turkey and cranberries and Parker House rolls. Mrs. Dowdle gave us the directions to Aunt Madge's house, whoever she was. Mrs. Dowdle had been particular about our going to Aunt Madge. "Who is she anyway?" Ruth Ann wanted to know. "Is she a poor old widow woman?" "Well, she's poor, all right, and old as the hills," Mrs. Dowdle pondered. "Though I don't know if you could call her a widow woman. Nobody in that family ever got around to marrying."
"Then is she an old maid?"
Ruth Ann inquired. "Well, I don't know as you could call her that either," Mrs. Dowdle muttered. Dad was all ears for what he could hear from up front. Mrs. Dowdle reached up to poke him. "Turn left at that Burma shave sign, preacher." Up a turning was what looked like a large junkyard. "Turn up that lane," Mrs. Dowdle directed. She had to point out the house itself. It lurked low, and the roof was patched with Coca-Cola signs. We all helped to carry Aunt Madge's Thanksgiving dinner. "Go on in," Mrs. Dowdle said. "She don't lock up." Inside was a lot like outside and somewhat colder. You could see your breath. Dad had to duck in the doorway. The floor wasn't all there. Then over by a stove, a pile of rags became an old, old woman in a lazy boy recliner.
"That's the oldest looking woman I ever saw," Ruth Ann said.
Mrs. Dowdle nodded. "She was only about 3 years behind me in school." We had to clear a plank table for someplace to put down the dinner. The old, old woman noticed us. She had a long red nose she kept wiping with a matching bandana. "Get off my place," she said. "We've brought you your Thanksgiving dinner," Mrs. Dowdle bellowed at her.
"My what?"
Aunt Madge said.
"It ain't even Thanksgiving."
"Yes, it is," Mrs. Dowdle boomed, looming over her. Aunt Madge squinted up. "From the look of you, it's Halloween." Mrs. Dowdle wore her cap with the flaps. Aunt Madge wore a big floppy hat tied under her chins with two mufflers.
"Who are you anyhow?"
Aunt Madge's eyes were slits. Her eyebrows were briars.
"You that big gal married Dowdle?"
"That's me. You want some chestnut dressing? When did you eat last?"
"I don't know," Aunt Madge said. "What day is it?
And who's these two kids? Your grandkids?" "They might be," Mrs. Dowdle said. "I'll have this boy stick some more cobs in your stove," meaning me. "I don't feel the cold," Aunt Madge said. "I'm too old. What's that little gal doing?" Meaning Ruth Ann. "She's dishing up some of Wilhelmina Weidenbach's candied yams for you, but you won't like them. They're so sweet they'd set your teeth on edge. If you had any." "Where is my teeth?" Aunt Madge wondered. Looking around, she spied Dad pouring out a jar of gravy on the sliced turkey. "Who's that owl hoot?" "He's the preacher," Mrs. Dowdle bellowed at her. "What's he here for?" "I brought him to preach your funeral in case you die before we get some eats in you." Ruth Ann stared at that. So did Dad. "Ain't dying today," Aunt Madge said. "I'm waiting for Thanksgiving, because they're going to bring me my dinner." That scene has layers. It may need some teaching. Does Aunt Madge really not recognize Mrs. Dowdle, her neighbor for 89 years? Does she really not know it's Thanksgiving? She knows. She knows. I know she knows. I wrote her. But she's taking charity, and she has her pride. And so this scene is a love story. I wrote it in the hotel room in a blizzard. I wrote it standing up, moving around the room, acting out all the parts. Always write your dialogue standing up. It improves the pace. And in all of my novels, there's an old person or two reaching across a lifetime to touch a young hand, because there were young people like that for me, and I can't be sure they're there for my readers. The young ones are my favorites because they're starting on their journeys, and I want to be there with a book in my hand, a book of paper pages, turning to the past and turning to the future. Because like you, I'm the sort of person who believes that only readers have futures. And as Winston Churchill once said, words are the only things that last forever. How do you write a novel? I will tell you. You find the best opening line you can, and then you write the novel that goes with it. Because barring the title, the most important words you ever write are the first lines of the first page. Because if your readers don't like the first line, they'll never see the second. Required reading was abolished in the 1970s. Nobody has to read us, and we must never warm up on anybody's time. I write all of my novels 6 times. And just like you, I don't get anything right in the first 5 tries either. But sometimes I find I have written the first scene 25 times. I regularly find, too, my opening line on page 6. But that's all right. You throw out the first 5 and go. I cannot stress the importance of the opening line. So I spend a part of every week at Shakespeare and Company with a small, discreet notepad and pen, writing down other people's opening lines. I can't use them. They've been used. But I want to know what these books say that publishers are publishing now. They're not all good opening lines. And of course, the opening lines for adults are shoddy, because writing for adults is like playing tennis without the net. But I get ideas from other people's opening lines, and I collect great opening lines. They are an inspiration. What is this the opening line from? Where's Papa going with that axe? I wish I'd written that line. Yes. Ooh. But it was written the year I was a senior in high school. I was way too old for that book then, but I'm not now. Where's Papa going with that axe? You can't beat it. It's a question that draws the reader in. It's all on one line. If your first sentence runs for more than 2 lines, you're doing a rough draft. And it has Papa and axe on the same line. It doesn't get any better. But no first line is foolproof. I said to a group the other day of adults, where's Papa going with that axe, the first line of? And a woman said, The Shining? You write one thing, people read another. Who wrote this book? It did very well. When he was nearly 13, my brother Jim got his arm badly broken at the elbow. Yes. To Kill a Mockingbird,
yes. Let us, I wonder if Harper Lee chose that first out. I can't believe it. Notice it doesn't begin, we were growing up in a little southern town when nothing ever happened. No, never start with setting. And it doesn't begin with, I had a father named Atticus Finch, and I worshiped the ground he walked on. True. But look what the opening line is. When he was nearly 13, my brother Jim got his arm badly broken at the elbow. You hear it snap. You know a boy's name. You're into the story. There's no going back from it. I love these opening lines because I'm looking for my next one. There is a writer in a young writer today named M.T. Anderson. Are we reading him? It's not my kind of writing, so I can admire him with a pure heart. And he has a wonderful book called Feed. And it's set in just the immediate future when teenagers are freed from earbuds and iPods and Blackberries and computer screens. Now they have a wire, a feed directly into the brain. So they can order from Abercrombie and Fitch just by thinking about it. So it's not about the future at all. Here is his opening line. We went to the moon to have fun, but the moon turned out to totally suck. Now that's called establishing your voice on the first line. As I say, it's not my kind of writing, but here's to him. Is there a perfect opening line? Yes, and I found it. I did. I found it in a place called Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Has anyone ever heard of it? I was invited to go to Calvin College. And when you're invited to a place called Calvin College, you don't expect to have a good time. And indeed, I didn't. But I got a novel out of it. Calvin College does what every college ought to do. It brings in young people from its area every year for a day of writing. Fifth graders and seventh graders. So they identify the brightest young writers coming up. And the young writers see this handsome campus. So they said, we want you to come out and meet with fifth graders and seventh graders. Teach them how to write. You have 45 minutes with each group. Well, I thought, I can only do one lesson, and that will be the big one, getting an opening line that works. So I pictured the fifth graders and me sitting around a table working on our opening lines and making them better. There were 500 of them in stadium seating, and I was heavily mic'd on a thrust stage. And there were the teachers at the top clinging, teachers who had already asked the university if they had to stay for the meeting. But I had one lesson plan, and I was stuck with it. So I said to them, you are only as good as your opening line. You are my readers, but your readers are your teachers. Put an opening line that your teacher would like, and you'll get a good grade. 500 fifth graders thought about that. They had never thought of entertaining a teacher. These people are paid to be here. So I said, what interests a teacher? Silent. What interests a teacher, I said. And finally, one voice said, coffee. Oh, it was a long morning, and that was the high moment. And then in the afternoon, here came the seventh graders, 500 of them. And the concept of entertaining a teacher brought out some naked hostility with this bunch. There was much throwing of hair among the girls. I said, what interests a teacher that you could put in the opening line? What interests a teacher? And finally, a breaking boy's voice said, trouble. And I said, yes, trouble. Put trouble in the opening line. Put trouble in the opening line. Well, it was a long day in my life. And I don't know if they believe me, but I believe me. And I had decided I would write an opening line, a foolproof opening line, though I didn't have the book that goes with it. But now I do.
It's called The Teacher's Funeral. You don't think I'm stooping too low, do you? And the opening line is, "If your teacher has to die, August isn't a bad time of year for it." That occasioned my first standing ovation from fifth graders. And so, you're only as good as your opening line. And your first chapter is your last chapter in disguise. The first and the last are the bookends that hold the book up. So when I finish a novel, it takes a year, because I write it six times, and I go a lot of places. When I finish the book and see how it ends, I take the first chapter, and without rereading it, I throw it away. Then I write the opening chapter that really goes with that book. Now that I know all of the elements of the book, because they must all be present in the opening scene. The first scene is the table of contents. It just doesn't look like it. And you learn how to do that by reading the works of Dame Agatha Christie. All of her clues are on the first pages. You just didn't notice them at the time. Because all stories are stories of suspense to keep the pages turning. And all stories are family stories. And that's why we're keeping Christmas together as families and readers. Thank you. Stephen.
What instrument do you use to write with?
My instrument? No, longhand's too slow for me, and I try to write at the pace of conversation. So I use an IBM Selectric typewriter. I have one and a spare. And I forgot to turn one off, and it glowed hot all night long. I like the sound. I've typed always. I've typed all my life. And indeed, when I have to put down occupation on a, I always put in typist. It's a good question, because we get into the way we write, and that's the way we write.
I did.
And it's true. I think most of who we are is determined in those first five fleeting years before we ever see school. Schools don't build foundations. Schools build upon foundations. Yes? See how they are? Do you not wish to encourage me into new areas? No. I don't know. I didn't think I was going to do this one. But she's only 89. There's plenty of life in her. And that boy had two sisters. Maybe. But I'll have to think about it. I have a book coming next year. And it is dedicated to Trish Marks. Is she here this week? Oh, Trish, there you are. Yeah. She's in our list of writers with us this evening. Important book coming from her. Maybe she'll come here and tell us about it. She is the dedicatee of my novel next year. That's why I mention her now. It will be called Three Quarters Dead, and believe me, Grandma's not it. It was my first foray into contemporary writing since iPods, Blackberries, Twitter, and tweet. It's a story about a girl with a cell phone in one hand. So it's a horror story happening. Because it's the first thing your reader sees. Whatever your first reader sees first, that's it. Yes. By the way, I never use the word prologue because I'm afraid that's different. I call it chapter one. And they say, oh, well, how short. I think I'll go keep on reading. Watch prologue. It'll come back to bite you. But yes. Don't look for her name. You're not going to find it. Yeah. No, when they're gone, they're gone. But actually, the final chapter I use has all those elements in it and more, but it's shorter. So I haven't really thrown it out. I've recycled it. But you know, you will notice, I notice too, that if I write the first chapter last, it's shorter than it would have been because I'm not wandering. I know what it should be in it, and it's much more tightly paced, so I don't need it anymore. I don't like keeping back drafts. I keep moving ahead, and I don't read what I have written before until I'm looking for a sequel, or a young person, or a person writes and says, what did you mean on page 42? And you just hope they name the book. There you are. I have books for you. And you're Maud? Can you imagine old ladies being called Great Aunt Amber? Does it work?
Well, thank you, everyone. I just wanted to say a couple of words. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and it's really a pleasure to have so many people here tonight for a really great way to end our programming season for this fall. And what a special occasion to be celebrating Mr. Peck's 30th book. I hope you can stay behind. For those of you who don't have to run, we have refreshments and some edibles. And I wanted to tell Mr. Peck that I have to go home tonight and tell my wife that Charles Dickens is being replaced this year by this book, because I read it 2 weeks ago and I was chuckling in bed night after night, and she said, what are you reading now? And it occurred to me when I finished it 2 days ago, I thought, this is the book for this season, so we'll be reading that at home. So please stay with us, and thanks for all of you for coming tonight.